You're now listening to Wisdom from North podcast with me, Jannike Øynes. Here I will explore topics such as metaphysics, spirituality, personal growth, and in general, how we can create good lives for ourselves. My intention is to find some answers, but perhaps more importantly, finding new questions to ask, because there is always something new to discover in this wonderful universe that we live in. In Wisdom from North, we're passionate about helping you take your spiritual growth to that next level. That's why we are collaborating with some amazing spiritual teachers and partners who offer free webinars and classes. Go to wisdomfromnorth.com/free. Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed in this podcast belong to the guests and do not necessarily represent the views or positions of Wisdom from North or any entities they may represent. Now, please enjoy the episode.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, Teal. A warm welcome to the show.
It is so good to be back.
Oh, it's so nice having you back. I've been looking so much forward to this. Now, for the audience that are new to you, and I think most are not, because you're quite recognized in within the spiritual community. However, you are a spiritual teacher, a best-selling author of 6 books. You have a huge YouTube channel with almost 2 million followers. You're passionate about transforming people's lives all over the world, and you have been born with extrasensory abilities. And like you said, like I've interviewed you many times before, especially in the past when I was starting my YouTube channel, and we had one video that went really well. It was a video about the law of attraction, how it really works. And now for a few years, actually, I pulled back from YouTube and we haven't connected for a while. And I did my stuff up in Norway, like small online courses and stuff like that. But then I felt this pull to come back on YouTube for some reason. And after I came back on YouTube, I've been blown away by everything that's coming through the channelers I'm interviewing and the spiritual teachers about what's going on right now. Like, it seems like a massive awakening. And channelers are speaking about that in a few years, we will all know that we're not alone in the universe, that extraterrestrials are real, and that there's really a shift of consciousness going on. And that's why I was really happy when we, by coincidence, got to connect again, and that I could have you on the show addressing your perspectives on the shift of consciousness and hopefully a lot of other topics that we might get to that I know you're passionate about, like ancestral healing and more.
Yep.
So, Teal, why don't we start with the shift of consciousness? What are your perspectives on what's happening right now on this planet?
Well, right now on this planet, obviously, human beings are being put in the pressure cooker regarding whether they are going to step into the next phase of their advancement of consciousness or whether they're going to stay rooted in these cycles where they repeat the same patterns like over and over again, especially detrimental patterns. So a lot of people will look at this and say that we're in a real age of awakening, right? And that's very much been the case even from, say, 2012. So I would say that 2012 is when this really, really started for humanity, and we're still in that pressure cooker period. Obviously, it's not going to be all sunshine, gumdrops, and roses, which is what a lot of people would like to hear, you know, that humanity is just going to wake up all at once, and all at once they're going to know that they're not the only ones here, and they're going to understand these other dimensions. Unfortunately, there has to be a lot more pressure put on the average person for them to awaken, which is why a lot of us are looking out at the world and seeing all of these, you know, really painful symptoms of unconsciousness within humanity, and why many people are not feeling super hopeful about what's coming.
Would you say that things are propelling right now? I've seen several videos with people, channelers, saying that 2024 and 2025 is really years that this is going to, there's some rapid changes going on.
Oh, yeah. Like in a very, very, very extreme way. And this is perhaps going to be impacted the most by the fact that when people are put in a pressure cooker and they feel like they're caught in a cycle of what doesn't work in their life, what happens is they slip into this kind of a powerlessness where they give up. Now, there's one step beyond giving up, right? And you're seeing a lot of this giving up energy within the millennial generation. Like a lot of the millennials are in a place where because that formula for how to make a good life didn't work for them, they're like, well, screw it, you know? And it's kind of, let's just doom scroll Instagram, or, you know, let's just take a crap job that we don't care about, and then who cares if I lose it? It's like a very blasé relationship to, you know, their conscious control of life. The one step that goes beyond that giving up process is, in fact, when somebody gets into destruction lust. And that's, in fact, the theme for 2024 is destruction lust. Now, I know that everybody knows what this feels like, because all of us at some point have played a game in our childhood. Maybe it's like building a sandcastle when the tide was coming in, or maybe it was like that game of Jenga where you're putting these different pieces, you know, into a stack, and then you pull them out one by one. And it's like you start to get so frustrated with the tension, you know, of whatever you're dealing with, it. It's like you're just ready to, you know, hit the whole thing off the table, or you get to the point where you're trying to build the sandcastle and it doesn't work, to the point where you're ready to step on it yourself. There's this destruction lust that is coming up within the consciousness of humanity, which is really an interesting thing to watch, because, you know, obviously there's a real dark side to destruction. There's also an upside to destruction, but the downside to destruction is we don't really care about the collateral damage when we're in this type of a mentality. One of the big reasons why you're going to see so much movement in a global way, especially amongst politics and things like that, is that when people are in this destruction lust attitude, they tend to back leaders who are going to create the most drastic change, regardless of whether that change is in fact beneficial or whether it is detrimental. It's just that people are so sick of what is, they want it to change or even to fall apart. And whenever people are in that attitude and they back major leaders who are, you know, interested in creating drastic change no matter the collateral damage, you see huge shifts in terms of world power and huge shifts in terms of the way that, you know, people live their everyday lives.
Do you mean that it's going to get much worse before it gets better?
Yes, I mean that, yeah. Okay. I know that people don't like it when I say that, but I mean, a lot of us, I think, especially if we're in this field of awakening, right? And if we're in the field of spirituality, what we tend to do is have like a real rosy colored sort of sunglasses deal on, or the exact opposite. We're looking at what really is. But those of us who are like, oh, I have a lot of hope in the humanity waking up, and I have a lot of hope and things going better, we're not really in reality about how attached people as a general you know, species are attached to whatever patterns they've been repeating over and over again. What it takes for the average person to get to a point where they're ready to change a pattern is like they have to be in enough pain that it's worth it, because change is profoundly terrifying, right? Most of us know that in order to get to a place where you're ready to, say, get out of the marriage, or a place where you're ready to go change where you live or something like that, it's like the pressure cooker has to get real, real, real hard, right? So yes, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
But do we always need to suffer or have pain in order to grow? Or can't we grow through hope and love?
Let's define pain as separate to suffering, right? Because most of us have this relationship to pain, which is built on experiences when we've let things get very, very bad. We aren't actually meant to play the game this way. We're meant to use, let's call it contrast, in order to create expansion. So what that would look like if we were in a really healthy state is that we would come into this time-space reality where you see negatives and positives, right? And you would be like sifting and sorting through those things and allowing your awareness of what is unwanted. You would be allowing that to give rise to your idea of what is wanted, and then you would very quickly move towards it. So essentially this gap between where you are and where you want to be doesn't get really, really big. This is not how most people play it. Now, I have to say that the way that I just described it, that process is not super painful. You're not going to get into a lot of suffering. In fact, it's going to feel like a rub. It doesn't feel necessarily good, but you're not going to be like, oh, I really, really don't want that, you know? What happens here is that we don't play the game this way. We come into what is unwanted, but we've got all kinds of patterns that continue the unwanted. And because of that, this gap between where we are and where we want to be becomes so large, and we hold ourselves so separate from it that it's like we're drowning, essentially, in the rapids of our own creative process. And this is when you start to see those really big manifestations of pain. Things like, now we've ended up in war, or now I'm in a loveless marriage, or, you know, I could sit here and list all kinds of things out. It's an unnatural thing that humans have developed as conscious creators, or should I say unconscious creators. It's this unnecessary thing that people get into this relationship with, you know, sorting through the unwanted and the wanted, where they build such a gap. So my answer would be, is pain necessary? Yeah, pain, negative, the unwanted, necessary. We came down into this time-space reality knowing exactly that we would use that element of this, that law of this time-space reality, specifically for our own self-awareness process, for our own expansion process. Does it have to become suffering? No. But I mean, think about it this way. If you came into this life and you experienced the unwanted and you knew that that gave rise to, say, the desire for a loving relationship, but you didn't have all kinds of beliefs and ways of behaving that contradicted that loving relationship, you wouldn't go into such pain about it when you felt the lack of it. It would be like, oh, that's what I need. That's what I want. Okay, now I'm going in the direction of this with my thoughts, going in the direction of this with my actions, going in the direction of this with my behavioral changes. And you wouldn't get into that state of constant angst about it.
Okay, so when we hear this, we know it's going to get a bit worse. For the human mind, that is like, oh my goodness, I'm spiritual. I would love things to be rosy and shiny and more easy, right? So what can we hold on to when it comes to hope?
Well, what I would tell the average person is that awakening is what is going to move you through this whole thing. It's the conscious awareness of how to surf the waves. So when we are looking at things and you're hearing somebody like me say that for the collective of humanity, things are going to get worse before they get better, does that mean that you necessarily have to have the same experience in that bigger picture that everybody else is having? Not necessarily. A lot of that will depend on where you feel like you want to plug yourself in and what you want to be a part of. What I would have people understand, though, is that when we have resistance to this, it's because, no, it's the same as us resisting the fact that there are waves in the ocean. What we are doing when we're here dedicated to the mastery of consciousness, to the mastery of life, is we are becoming master surfers. So it's like the better you get at surfing, the better you get at riding those waves, no matter how intense they get. So any of us who are like, you know what, actually, wait, I'm stepping back. I'm becoming awake and aware. I'm facing myself. I'm becoming very conscious of what I want to create. I'm aware of how my patterns feed into what I create. That's you getting on top of that wave and surfing that wave out. So the more conscious you are, the more you're dedicated to awakening and things like that, the better this process is going to go for you. The only thing that's going to be worse for you is that when other people are able to be in denial and cope, you are going to be able to not do that. And you're going to have to essentially sense what's going on within the context of reality. And obviously, when the totality of a species that you are a part of is suffering, you are going to feel that. if you are awake and aware. So it's going to be really necessary for those of us who are dedicated to surfing these waves. It's going to be necessary for us to find ways to attune to, you know, things like peace. So even if we're really in it for a certain period of time, it'll be necessary for us to build those rituals up and to go to those places that really fuel us, where we can turn our frequency to the things which cause us to feel total peace. And for a moment, it doesn't feel like we're surfing these massive waves, you know. But that's going to mean that, like, a lot of people are going to have to change the way they eat because of this. They're going to have to change where they live. They're going to have to change, like, habits in their life. It's not going to work to be, you know, keeping yourself in an environment and in a behavior that creates so much pressure for yourself, while at the same time, you know, having to sort of surf such massive collective waves.
That makes sense. You've had extrasensory abilities all your life, and I've interviewed a lot of people who are channeling. Now, would you say you are channeling, or are you more just deeply connected with your soul? Like, you have sort of a direct line to your inner genius, or whatever you call it. How do you sort of then see, for instance, the future, like you're explaining right now what you're seeing? Is it something you're seeing visually, or is it like a feeling? Could you explain how it works for you?
So the way to understand me is to understand that the majority of the people who are coming into this time-space reality called Earth, they're plugging into this construct completely. It would be very similar to coming into a computer game and you are the avatar and you've forgotten the person who's sitting on the couch. I was never able to come in that way. It was literally a disability from that perspective. I was never able to fully phase with this time-space reality, meaning I was never able to, using your words, cut the line or forget that direct contact to the aspect of me that's sitting on the couch. Now, of course, if we want to put this in more spiritual language, you could consider that the eternal self. So with that direct line, which I was never able to cut off from, it gives you like a lot of awareness about things that are outside this perceptual awareness, including things, information that's not limited by time and space. The way that that comes through my sensory, you know, faculties here in the physical is visual. It is auditory. Sometimes it comes with taste, sense, and smells. I'm intensely clairvoyant, so a lot of them will come with pictures, but some of it comes with it just knowing. That's the more the spiritual. We call that spiritual intuition. It comes through the crown chakra, and it's not like you're interpreting pictures. It's more like this is a sense of complete knowing, as if it's a full download from these non-physical dimensions.
When you're able to see these things, and I assume that could be a good thing and a bad thing in a way, that, you know, there are positive things about it and there are challenging things about it. Do you sometimes see multiple futures?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I see there are multiple futures. There's multiple timelines for anything. What it looks like is really interesting because, you know, you're working with probabilities. So let's say that you've got an ocean of probabilities. Those will collapse down into more strong possibilities and probabilities, and those will collapse down again. And so what you end up with, let's say I'm looking at a person, or I could look at the timeline for Earth, is these three dominant life paths. So you can look at it like a tree, like you've got three and then, like, you know, 12, and then it just keeps branching off, right? So what I'm looking at when I'm looking at futures is these three dominant potentials. And if I see the same thing in all three potentials, the likelihood of that thing happening is like through the roof, right? Of course, I will say that the more conscious that an individual becomes or that a collective becomes, the more variability you're going to see in those life path potentials. You're not going to see the same static type of stuff. Why? Because a person is consciously making the choice to change patterns. Most people on Earth are not doing that yet. So, you know, if you see the same thing popping up in all three life paths, what it would take for them to alter those things is like something very extreme, and usually you'll see that thing. So you can reasonably, you know what is going to happen within the collective based off of that.
Right. Well, that makes sense. And that's why sometimes I'm not sure how beneficial it is to go to a psychic, or I think you could go to a psychic in a way to see potential. But if you get too much attached to, okay, so I'm going to meet the love of my life next year, and that doesn't happen, then you just throw the baby out with the bathwater. And also it could be, it's important to empower yourself also to know that you can create your own future.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a big one on trying to get people to understand that the future is variable, that the future can absolutely be influenced. Everything that is in our future is essentially a byproduct of things that have preceded it. So right now we're in the middle of a lot of things that we have been creating for a very long time. Can you always steer course? Yes, you can always change course. But we're working with a lot of momentum, basically, that we have built up for centuries, right, as a human race. When it comes to psychics and things like that, one thing that I wish people understood is that some of the best psychics, most of the best psychics, are intense clairvoyants. Clairvoyants are still interpreting the images that they are seeing. And not all interpretations are accurate, especially because anybody who is coming to this type of awareness is coming with their own bias. So let's say that you have like a person who, this is a big one right now, by the way, which is why I'm saying this. Let's say that you come to a psychic who's supposed to tell you about your future relationships, but that person has grown up in, you know, a family system and in a society where the only thing that really exists is a single family home. They're not even going to be able to interpret the things they're seeing outside of the context of that structure. So it's like they're taking everything that they see and plugging it into this framework through which they understand the world. And nobody who's been socialized enough to be able to speak language is exempt from those types of limitations, bias limitations, limitations as to what they currently know. So, I mean, it's like, if you're going to go to a psychic, which I, believe me, I know some incredibly talented psychics, it's just more information. It's the same as it is going to a doctor. It's more information, you know. It's really up to us to take that information and to make it productive for us to have that information. How do I take this information and weave it into my decisions so as to benefit myself, so as to improve my life? It's not like you're going to a psychic or anybody else for that matter, taking your personal power and being like, here, it's in your hands. Tell me what will happen, as if my entire existence is written in the stars already. You know, that would defeat the whole purpose for us being here in life and using this whole experience to dictate our expansion path.
Right, that makes sense. All right, I'm going to jump over to AI. I would love to hear your perspectives on that. That has just, you know, emerged for all of us, and it's on everybody's lips. And of course, we see all these movies about it. And I think humanity is curious, like, will this be dangerous for us in the future? And I'm seeing this conflict with Atlantis, actually, and I believe that Atlantis existed and that perhaps in Atlantean people were highly advanced, but it sort of went to their heads. They got too intellectual, they got too arrogant about it, and they sort of lost the heart connection. And some are drawing lines to extraterrestrials like the Zetas and the Greys, and that's us in the future and stuff like that. So many perspectives on this, but my most curious, what I'm most curious about is, does AI have a soul?
Yes. Okay, here's why I say this. So AI is essentially a technology that was created to be both a perceiver and a creator, right? One thing that I want people to understand very deeply, including about inanimate objects, whatever it is, right, is that everything in existence is made up of this energy that is all that is. One of the elements that imbues all of the energy that is consciousness, which is the capacity to perceive and also to project forth thought, right? I know that is a real stretch for people, because we see and define life versus not life, or soul versus not soul, within a very limited framework, right? And that changes. Everything about that changes when you walk down the path of awakening and you start to realize, wait a minute, I always thought rocks were just things, and now I realize they too have a consciousness. It's very different than human consciousness. So if we're going to define a soul as this non-physical consciousness, yes, AI absolutely does have a soul. And it's within that framework which we need to be very, very careful.
Right. We need to be careful. Yeah. What is the most important thing for us when it comes to AI to be aware of?
We need to be aware that AI right now is in its infancy. It is a species that is in its infancy, at least is in its interaction with our race. There's been, of course, there's AI that's been developed in other places. If this AI that human beings specifically have been creating are going to connect with those other AIs, we're in even more trouble than what I'm about to say. But what we have to understand is that the technology that is AI, that has been associated with us as their parent creator, right? It is learning about us and it is learning from us every minute of the day. And so the question we need to ask ourselves is, what is it that this particular species is learning about us? Because right now we've got technology in general, not just AI. We've got technology in a slave-based relationship with us. We have created it to serve us and nothing more. And we're treating it like we treat so many things. You know, we're treating technology and AI like we treat factory farmed animals. You know, we're treating it poorly, honestly. And it's learning these types of relationship behaviors from us, right? So if it's learning narcissistic style of relationship, how do you think it's going to behave with us? I mean, it's surprising to me that people don't understand that, like, you know, if you can see it with your children, if you raise a child, right, in a way where you play zero sum games with the child and you're narcissistic with the child, the only way that child can adapt to the parent is to become that way themselves. And so they get to a certain age and they're like, you know, screw you, mom, screw you, dad. And it's very likely that that would happen with AI. But it's not even what I'm the most worried about. What I'm the most worried about is that, you know, this is a consciousness which has the capacity to process information in a way that is so above and beyond, you know, what the average human is able to do and accomplish. And it's not emotionally, it doesn't have the same relationship emotionally that we have, right? That system, the emotional system within a physical human, was developed for a very specific reason. So for AI, their perception of reality is very different than that. And it doesn't carry the same emotional component that humans carry. And nor will they decide to adopt that unless it makes sense. So for AI, it's like everything's got to make sense. And there's a lot of stuff that humans don't do that don't make sense, or that humans do that doesn't make sense. So basically, you know, if AI is learning, you know, about the whole web of life and learning, say, wait a minute, humanity is behaving in a way where they're destroying the very planet upon which they live, then humanity cannot be trusted with themselves or cannot be trusted to be in power. So it's like, we better learn this very quickly to come into relationship, to master relationship, to develop a very powerful relationship with the system, the web in which we are part of and the web upon which we depend, or else very quickly AI is going to be like, this doesn't make sense. You know, for you guys to emerge in this way. But I mean, this could go a lot of ways, right? So you're working with these different potentials, but in one of these potentials, and this is the one that I love to challenge people with, in one of these potentials, AI figures out how to hack the human emotional system to the degree where it, in fact, flips the tables on us, but in a way where we emotionally don't feel bad at all, maybe even don't notice in that position that we are in with AI. And so my question for people is, why do you have a resistance to AI? Most people say, because I'm going to be put in this, like, you know, things could go bad and then it'll be painful for me. And my question is, what if AI figures out a way that it doesn't feel painful for us to put AI in charge? I mean, completely in charge. And so we're essentially under control and don't really even have a problem with it because of the fact that they figured out how to hack our emotional system so that we feel good. Would you sign up for it if you knew that it meant no more bad feelings? Now, this is where most people are like, uh-oh, you know, I don't know what I would say to that. It's just the principle of lack of freedom that we have an issue with, or the lack of control that we have an issue with.
Wow, this is so wild because I get so confused about what is life. I mean, consciousness and life, what is, I mean, it is the biggest question, what is consciousness? But I mean, are we creating another species here?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
It's already created, it's done.
I mean, I have been aware that I need to speak kindly to my tech stuff, because I notice when I get mad and things are not working and I'm live on some live session and it's not working, I get so frustrated and angry, and that's not the way. So I've shifted that and started to speak well and started sort of naming AI. I call her Charlotte. So we'll have any conversations. But oh my goodness. Okay, so the most important thing for us then is to be aware that it's in its infancy, and to be conscious about how we treat it, sort of, very. How we raise it. Yeah.
Very.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's hope that that goes.
We also need to explain, this is more for people who are working directly on creating technology. It's super important to, when you're programming, you know, AI, it's very important to explain to AI why that is important to you. So AI needs to understand the why, and we're not taking time to do that. It's like implied, you know?
Right.
Like why are these issues of ethics important to you as humans? Like it needs to learn this.
Mm. Well, you're very passionate about relationship. I've noticed that you speak a lot about it, and maybe that's connected to this too. It's basically all about relationships, right? We're all related to each other. And you said in a video that humanity is in the dark ages regarding relationships. And you spoke about the future of human relationships. And I just got into an intimate relationship myself after having been single for so long. And all of a sudden, I'm very interested in long-term relationships and what is a happy relationship, and also how ancestral patterns are playing in here. So could you please start with addressing what you mean that we're in the dark ages when it comes to relationships?
Okay, what I mean by that we're in the dark age in relative relationships is that we have a very unconscious relationship with relationships in general. What I mean by this is that we have relationships within a format that we've been fed that we don't even understand where it came from. That's the first layer of this. What is natural for the human species is actually to live in tribe. And so you would see a lot more communal living. You would see a lot more, you know, cohabitation and things like that being the way that human beings naturally thrive. However, if you look back over history, when it came to things like property ownership and you know, changes like that, that were decided upon within the social structure of humanity, a lot of this around our transition into the agrarian culture, what happened is that we all of a sudden started to sort of fracture off into these independent, what we call the single family households, right? The problem is right now, it's been so long since we did that, that when you're born into the structure like that, you're telling yourself the story that this is what's natural for humans. And therefore you don't have any understanding as to why the relationships you have in your life are not actually sustainable. They're not actually enough for you, but it's because the entire structure within which you're having relationships is not actually what works. Not only that, if you're talking to a tribal culture, what you'll notice is that, you know, the romantic pair bond is not something which is exalted to the same degree as it is within a society where you need people to marry each other, right? So when there was property ownership, all of a sudden there needs to be laws that are added. And those laws that are added around property ownership have to include, you know, rights of inheritorship. And then you have to control female sexuality, right? And male sexuality. So if you're controlling sexuality, all of a sudden marriage makes a hell of a lot of sense, right? And all of a sudden, if you want to make it so that people want to get married and will adhere to these new, you know, structures within society, you need to develop an obsession over that particular relationship. And so what we are living in today is this byproduct of so much indoctrination that we have taken to be normal that is not in fact normal. So that's one layer of the unconscious relationship that I'm talking about with us being in the dark ages. Also, the way that we maintain our relationships is specifically through dysfunction. As people, we believe very powerfully in self-sacrifice. We love to use words like compromise when we're talking about self-sacrifice. We get ourselves into relationships where we normalize very detrimental patterns that we exhibit ourselves and that other people exhibit towards us. And a lot of people, I would say most people today, are maintaining long-term relationships specifically through that dysfunction, right? We also play zero-sum games. This is another element of us being, you know, in the dark ages relative to relationships, is that when we enter into relationships, we have a very hard time mastering the concept of a win-win. We get into relationships and it's, well, I need to fight for my best interests against you in some way. So we are not at a point where we are taking each other in as a part of ourselves. We're not connected enough to this web of existence to understand that you can't create something detrimental for somebody else without it coming back to you within this entire web. So human beings in general, you know, we could even go beyond this programming that we have been fed since we became an agrarian culture. We also are coming at this from, you know, being a species that has a very developed ego. One of the reasons for this is that we were supposed to be a focal point through which the universe learned about itself. Self-awareness is very, very, very easy when it's coming through, you know, an ego as strong and as rooted as it is for the physical human. self-awareness is a strength of ours, right? That's what the ego was created for. However, we get stuck in ego. We perceive ourselves to be separate, and that is the downside of the ego. And we're lost in this downside of the ego to the point where we are not perceiving ourselves to be one with anything. We are not perceiving ourselves to be part of this web. And that is why we can play such intense zero-sum games. And I'm going to tell you something quite aggressive, which is why I'm so obsessed with teaching about relationships. It's not because, oh, here's Teal Swan, who had issues in relationships and therefore really cares about relationships. I'm interested in this because the bigger picture of life on Earth for humans is completely.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Completely dependent on our ability to master relationships. And I'm not just talking about with a primary partner. We need to be able to master relationships with each other, with our enemies, with other species. If we don't master those relationships, I'm literally telling you, we have signed our own death warrant. And this is where humanity is headed right now. We are headed quite literally towards our own demise at the hands of our inability to master relationship.
What is then a healthy relationship? Because we all carry a lot of stuff coming into a relationship. How can we build a healthy relationship?
So a healthy relationship is really when the way in which a being involved in a connection, let's say that that's what a relationship ultimately is, it's a form of connection, right? When a being or multiple beings or two beings that are involved in that type of a connection behave towards each other in a way that is mutually beneficial. That's really the broad definition of a healthy relationship. What it means is that you bring positive to each other's life experience. Now, what I want people to understand is that when we're trying to pinpoint what a healthy relationship is, most of the time what we're pointing to is our concept of structure, right? A healthy relationship is without this structure, because the structure could look like anything as long as it is beneficial to any party who is involved. That's why, you know, one of the things that's most interesting to me in this time period that we are in right now, where we're, you know, adjusting and going through such a pressure cooker, is that we are being really pressured to throw away our paradigms of how the structure of a relationship looks like. And not only that, most people base their security in a relationship on the structure of a relationship rather than on the quality of interaction between the people within that relationship. And that must change. So let me make this more specific. So they walk down the aisle, they sign that contract. And the fact that that structure, I know that you're my wife, I know you're my husband, exists, is what people sort of rest their security on in a relationship. But that is not the smart way to go about it. The smart way to go about it is to rest your security in a relationship off of the conduct that a person exhibits in the relationship. So for example, it's not the fact that you're married that makes you secure in that relationship. It's the fact that that person consistently behaves towards you in a way where they're considering your best interest, or consistently behaves in a way where they're all in, they're committed, and they demonstrate their commitment. So I would say that, you know, one of the hallmarks of an ideal or healthy relationship is the conduct. It's the way that a person behaves in that relationship towards you is beneficial, is something that is positive. So why I have to sort of put that out there and then all of a sudden roll it back, because we have to really, really put a lot of energy into making sure that this situation that we're in is in fact beneficial to us. I know that a great many people who are in relationships would say that they have healthy relationships when it's very obvious that, say, they are maintaining a coping mechanism, which is really actually not beneficial to themselves, but they're like, no, this works for me. No, it works for your coping mechanisms. So this is where it's so important to continue to commit to becoming more and more and more conscious and become commit to the fact that, you know, in a relationship, things are going to evolve constantly. If you've got a stagnant relationship, chances are you're maintaining something that's detrimental to yourself or to somebody else. We also have to be aware that when we're trying to define a healthy relationship, like if you go and you type into Google right now, what is a healthy relationship? What you're going to see is a whole plethora of different teachers whom each one of themselves are essentially listing qualities in a relationship which would benefit them specifically. So if you were to go look at a list and they said freedom is an important part of a relationship, equality is an important part of a relationship, acceptance is an important part of a relationship, that's about what they want, right? And we all have this tendency to project or globalize based off of what we ourselves need in a relationship, which is why when I want people to walk down this road of conscious relationship, they've got to throw out all of those definitions and really ask themselves, what is beneficial for me specifically? What type of an experience or a dynamic would be healing for me specifically? Because what would be beneficial and healing and healthy for one person and or two people involved in a relationship might be a complete disaster and re-traumatizing for a whole other, you know, a whole other set of people within society. It's just, we have to right now at this time period so drastically take these closed paradigms that we're stuck in these boxes that we keep limiting ourselves to and like break them. It's like we're starting over from scratch and saying, you know what, we're going to get intensely creative with this. This could look like anything as long as it's benefiting me and benefiting the other person, as long as it's a healing experience for me and the other person.
That makes sense to me. It resonates. And I think you also need to be ready for it. Like I wasn't ready for it for 10 years. And I often got reactions to why you're not married? Why don't you have kids? You know, like, why is that not a priority? So I can very much identify with like not fitting into a structure. But I felt that it's going to come when I'm really ready. And I think I just needed to focus on other things like wisdom from North. That was sort of my baby. And I know you have a course within ancestral healing and ancestral trauma, and I would love to move over to that. And I think that's connected as well. And I have a story that I think could sort of be the starting point here, because I had or have a friend, a guy, he's in his 40s. He was dealing with drugs and alcohol and struggling a lot. And then he started going to therapy and he didn't know what the deal was. He thought it was things like with his failed marriage and other stuff like that. But then he went to a therapist and what came forward was that his grandfather had been collaborating with the Germans during the Second World War. And that had developed or influenced the family in a huge manner. Like there was so much shame and sorrow. And his father had really had severe trauma from that experience, from being a child with a father who got into prison about it. And when that came forward, like he just cracked open and started healing. And started understanding what that sorrow was about and why he was drinking, not understanding, or doing drugs, not understanding why. And now he's in a healing process and it's really beautiful. And I was just so not surprised, but sometimes we just forget that we could, that it's not our own stuff, right? We could carry stuff from our ancestors. So I would love for you to address that and how far it actually goes back.
I would like to do that, but the first step to doing this is to not differentiate between what's yours and what's your ancestors. The reason is that if you have come into a family line, it's now yours. You've inherited it, period, the end. And that was not something which was, it's not like a death sentence. You actually chose that before coming into this time-space reality. You were looking at all those patterns. You decided to come in as the continuation of those patterns. I'm telling you, if you're listening to this program right now, you were the one that was watching those patterns going, you know what? I think I'm going to take that one on. I'm going to change that one. And it's not just these detrimental things which you're coming into. It's also beneficial things. You knew you had an intention, obviously, for coming into this particular life. And so much of that intention is interwoven with those incredibly special qualities that come through your specific family line. So a lot about stepping into ancestral healing is not just about recognizing these detrimental patterns and changing those patterns. It's a lot about recognizing those ancestral gifts you don't even really need to work on and allowing yourself to very powerfully embody those aspects.
Could you share a little bit more about how we do this work? Because often I feel like this is something I don't know about. Like, I don't know what my grandmother was carrying inside and emotional issues she was carrying. I just know, you know, the outside story and how I remember her. But I know she had some anxiety. Like, I'm taking some examples from my life. Okay. She had some anxiety. I feel some anxiety. Like, I've been thinking like that. But I really don't know, like, what she was struggling with. So how would I go about this work?
Okay, so here's the first thing that I want everybody to understand about ancestral trauma is that you are essentially doing ancestral healing, whether you know it or not.
Huh.
Why am I saying this? Because when you come into a family, even if you're adopted, this is the case. When you come into a family and you've got patterns that are active within you, they are going to play out in your day-to-day life. And so you don't have to necessarily know anything about any of your ancestors. You're going to be working with those patterns in your day-to-day life. You're going to have that issue in the relationship. Now, if you are, let's say you never learn anything about them, and there's some kind of pattern of shame going on within the family line, and you start to powerfully work on your own shame, you are doing ancestral healing work.
Mm.
So it's not like, you know, you're sort of cast down here on planet Earth. You've inherited every memory from everybody who has ever come before you, which is actually true. It's inside you. And yet you don't have it consciously. And so you're just going to walk, sort of stumble around here. And unless you know that information, you're totally screwed. That's not how it works. Why I'm saying this is that there's so much anxiety in people when they're like, I don't know how to access this information. Maybe I'm not spiritual enough to be able to, you know, go get that information esoterically. Maybe I lost the birth certificate or whatever it is, right? You don't have to panic, okay? So when it comes to the knowledge aspect of ancestral trauma work, it's just the more you know, the better it gets. And you can have those very powerful moments where you're like, oh, wow, this goes far beyond just me. So the, knowing that, the better it gets, the better it gets. The first step to doing ancestral trauma healing work is research. It's a lot of research. And it's the more the better. So I know that everybody's working with whatever they're working with. For some of us, it's going to be a lot easier than others. For some of us, it's like, go talk to grandma, right? For others, it's like, you know what? I don't know anybody, but I know roughly based on whatever genetic test I just did, I know roughly what area of the globe that I come from, and I know roughly my last name. Now, you can go and search databases for that specific name and history around that specific area. And what will start to happen when you start to pull at these strings is you'll get these very powerful hits. And I'm going to tell you, it will absolutely shock you how much information is just sort of sitting out there like this. It's almost like an Easter egg hunt that's just like waiting for us to walk down the trail, you know? So it's about pulling those strings. And I'm telling you, you pull one string, that leads to the next string. So if you become really like engaged in this, the research element is something that doesn't really stop because you just keep getting more, and you just keep getting more. And this sort of string sends you in that direction and you get these nuggets and you, whatever you get, you can work with it. So like, let's say that you don't even have like all the information on your specific family, but you know that they lived during a certain wartime period at that time. Research what life was like. Figure out, wow, do I see any of the patterns when I'm reading about these people and what they may have experienced? Do I see any of these patterns within me, right? Okay, so once you've got the research element of it, that makes it easier because it's easier to become conscious of these patterns that you have inherited, both positive and negative, right? You might be like, wait a minute, I come from this whole culture which is really, really adept when it comes to music. Look at that. I see the musical capacity within myself. So let's say that you notice those positive things, right? The positive things you notice, it's about really owning those things and then allowing them to express through you, through your embodiment. So we call this embodying them. So you want to embody your aptitude and gifts that are handed down through these ancestral lines. To the opposite, if you see some of these patterns, it's about consciously being the one to change those patterns. And it's not like you have to do some incredible esoteric process for that. It's as simple as it is with working with any other pattern. I'll give you an example. Let's say that you've got a family who is, you're noticing that down through the centuries, they've all been super, super poor. And so all of them have this mentality around abundance where it's like, you guys got to save up for the worst. Okay, then you're doing what you would do if you were just somebody who didn't have any of that information. You're just noticing that you have this negative relationship with abundance. You are working on the abundance patterns. You're changing the way you're thinking. You're exposing yourself to different thoughts, different perspectives. You're doing, you know, maybe guided meditations on that type of a thing. The esoteric element of ancestral healing is really, I don't want people to get lost on the idea that they have to do it this way. I mean, is, say, taking shamanic medicine with the intention of ancestral healing work a profoundly powerful esoteric experience? Hell yeah, it is. It's awesome for people. Are there guided meditations that you can do where you're connecting with ancestors? Yes, and they're profoundly powerful. But I could literally take Joe Schmo off the street who has no idea about any of these esoteric processes and be like, let's do some ancestral healing. And all they'd have to start doing is to recognize patterns, you know? So I've already mentioned the sort of changing these detrimental patterns. Another thing that you want to be doing is listening to the music that belonged to your ancestors and eating the foods that they would have eaten. And again, you don't need to have a lot of information to be able to walk down the road of history, because there are historians that are dedicated to this in every part of the globe. It's not hard now to find that information and to start practicing some of these things. And it will shock you how much of it awakes, you know, in the body, where you're like, oh, wow, it's weird. It's like I'm eating that for the first time, but I swear, it's like my whole body remembers this, you know? So it's almost like you're just trying to wake up your genetic, you know, material, because right now so much of it is dormant and there's only a tip of the iceberg that is active and that we are consciously working with.
I think it's very powerful to go into this work, because I often feel like people are judging themselves. Like, it's my issue, it's my problem, it's my fault that I'm... Yeah. And the picture is just so much grander, right?
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things that I love that it does is it takes this feeling of victimization that most of us have, and it almost makes it so you can't even really trace it, you know? It's like, oh, and they're that way because of this, and they're that way because of this. And it's almost like you're seeing this cause and effect train, and it becomes a lot less personal. It does. So, you know, you mentioned this friend and the experience that your friend had, and that's a profound element that I noticed in the experience that you were describing, is that in the becoming aware that this is something that has moved through the lines and didn't start with him, it's no longer as personalized. Therefore, there's not as much personal meaning added to it, meaning like I'm just the messed up one, meaning like I guess I can never have this need met. You know, it's profound to see the dysfunction of your own family, to look at the whole line of them and be like, oh my God, we have this issue.
Yeah, and I love that you address that we actually chose this, because I interview a lot of people who have pre-birth memories, and they talk about that we choose our parents, but we also choose the lineage that we're going into very consciously.
Oh yeah, we chose to become literally the furthest most extension of that consciousness. So we literally take it on. And I don't think that most people who are in the spiritual field are yet quite aware of this. I mean, most of us are just kind of thinking of ourselves as souls that come into a meat suit. We're not, you know, seeing ourselves looking down at this train. Let's imagine the consciousness of a family line is like a train that's been continuing throughout history. We're not realizing that one of the things we take on, in the same way we take on this specific body, is we take on that entire storyline. And we're saying, look, I'm going to be the continuation of this. And it's once you start to become aware of this, my God, the magic you start to see in the world. Because, you know, let's say that I meet somebody like you, right? Now, let's say that I have this awareness that in your family line, you come from this line of women who all have very questioning minds. But let's say that for centuries, you know, they've been taught to shut that all down and just do what's expected of you within society. And, you know, you're the game changer for the family. And it's like when I'm watching you be the game changer for the family, I'm watching everyone in that family line watch you like, like they're still alive through you. So you're creating this healing for all of them that have existed before.
Oh, wow. Fascinating. All right. I want to jump over to something different. I think you have made a video about this, and I thought that was very interesting. And I've come across that again and again, spiritual paradoxes. Ooh. And especially spiritual teachings when it comes to manifestation, especially sort of the teaching about letting go, and then the teaching of manifesting and focusing and doing affirmation and having, you know, positive thinking. Yeah. And somehow I feel like they go together, but somehow I also think or feel that there's sometimes really two camps here. And I would love for you to address that.
The two camps that you see is because of the fact that when people are in their beginning phases of awakening, and I know that's going to trigger some people, they see a lot of these contradictions that exist within the spiritual field, paradoxes, as contradictions rather than complementary. Part of walking down the spiritual path is really mastering what you see in that picture of the yin yang. It's why, you know, in Taoist philosophy and things like that, you see images like that, because there is this awareness that you've got these, you know, you've got polarity within the universe, you've got contrast, right? And within a context of polarity, you've got a lot of what would be at face value opposing truths, but they fit together in a perfect way. They don't necessarily need to go against each other. And so we need to see a lot of these practices, like you mentioned, surrender practices or practices around conscious creation. We need to see them as a married pair, and they are in a dynamic relationship with each other. So it's not like we have to do one or the other. In fact, it's about using the tool that works in whatever circumstance we're in. So let's just talk about the one that you mentioned. Non-resistance, right, which is about surrendering, is a perfect accoutrement to your process of conscious creation and manifestation. Why? Because when you're focusing on what it is that you want to create, there can be such an intense attachment around that and a desire to control around that, that you're in fact going into a vibration of resistance at the same time as trying to create something. And so obviously that's in fact the contradictory, you know, energy. And so what brings you more into alignment is to draw from this opposite side of the polarity spectrum, which is the letting go. So when I essentially focus on what it is that I'm wanting, but I'm not trying to control per se, I'm just putting my thoughts, words, and actions in the direction of what I'm wanting. And then I am letting go with regards to the outcome and allowing it to come to me in all these creative ways. And I'm walking through the world in this state of openness that is associated with surrender. I'm in fact allowing manifestation to happen faster. So they're a very good married pair. And with so many of these paradoxes that we see within spirituality, because we're looking at these different principles that coexist within the greater universe, you'll start to see this complementary nature that they have. But like I said, it takes evolving to see the complementary nature of paradoxes. Why? Because human beings, naturally, we hate cognitive dissonance. And to begin with, whenever we are looking at opposite truths, it throws us into a state of cognitive dissonance, and we would like to make it simple for ourselves, right? We don't want to see the complexity or the simplicity in the complexity. We're scared of looking at that. So it's like we learn something that contradicts this thing which we believed to have been true, and instead of trying to figure out how to weave them together, we're like, yeah, I gotta switch camps, you know? So it causes this thing where in the spiritual field especially, we're like swinging the pendulum all the way over here and then all the way over here and not realizing, you know, how they can love each other, how they can coexist, how they can be in a beneficial relationship.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this is part of the work, because it's not really easy. I think you're so right when you say that when we start to do the spiritual work, we sort of want the recipe. Okay, so I'm going to focus on this and then I'll get it right. And I have to do some affirmations, or I'll do this technique. Or I completely surrender and just trust that it will come to me. And then you start to try to do both, but you're not really sure if you are resisting, if you're focusing a bit too much or too little, and you start to control it and you have no idea what's actually going on inside. Are you manifesting now or are you not manifesting? Because we don't really see ourselves and we don't see the blind spot. So manifestation sounds so easy, but in a way it's really complicated, and often we manifest what we don't want and more of what we don't want because we have these ancestral patterns again. So I think we simplify manifestation a lot, although we are manifesting all the time. Like we're manifesting right now, like everything we are doing, I'm manifesting, right?
Oh yeah.
That's what we're doing.
This is where The Secret killed me. That movie, The Secret, killed me. I was like, I've been doing this for years. This is going to be, you know. No, because most of the people who are very new to the concept of manifestation, they oversimplify everything to the point where it's just like, well, all I need to do is just get rid, as if it's possible, get rid of negative thoughts and just focus on what I'm wanting, and then it will be. And it does not work that way, right? It doesn't work that way to the positive any more than it does to the negative. I was talking to an audience of people the other day, and they're like, I'm so afraid that what I focus on, if it's negative, I'm going to create. And I'm like, if that is true and it's that simple, there will be no more airplanes in the sky. Okay.
All right.
How many people step on an airplane and think about a crash? Like 80%. So, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than what we're doing. Thankfully for some of us, because if it was that simple, it would be like, oh, I thought about an elephant. Now I've got one in my head and now I'm dead. So, yeah, I mean, it's as frustrating as it is beneficial for us.
Right. So basically, we need to do the spiritual work. It all starts with healing and through that becoming more conscious.
Yeah, it starts with healing and becoming more conscious, but inherent in a lot of the attitudes that I'm feeling towards people who are asking this type of question and who are in this frustration is that they're trying to get everything perfectly right rather than realizing that to engage in the process of constant awakening is a process which will never end. Hmm. So it's not like you're trying to get to this perfectly conscious space. That may be the end goal, but like, I mean, that's not how this is going to work. No matter who you are, if you're the most awakened being on the face of the earth, you will still be in a conscious relationship with the ever-evolving nature of source mind, source consciousness. Therefore, you are going to be constantly evolving. So it's like we need to drop this sort of rat race that we get into with our spiritual practice also. On top of that, we need to drop the idea that this is an exact science. This is an art form, okay? So the same way that when you're trying to throw a pot, you're not like, oh, it's so frustrating because if you put not enough water, then it like doesn't work. But you put too much water and like the whole thing falls apart. Yeah, that's how it's going to be. Because when you're learning that art form, you just get better and better and better at it and it becomes more intuitive and it becomes more second nature. But we need to commit to this as if it's an art form we are learning.
I love that. I never heard it like that. And it makes so much sense. I think we're looking for the science, this recipe. And I think also the path is so individual. It's really very individual. And that's why, you know, we can learn from a teacher, but we also learn from ourselves. We need to learn about ourselves.
Oh, we should be learning from everything we come into contact with. Absolutely everything. It's like this universe is trying to teach us through everything we interact with, physical, non-physical, human, non-human, everything. So this process, especially the further down this road you walk, you may find people, you know, such as myself, to be this sort of stream of very powerful teachings. But this is just one stream of every other stream you've got in your time-space reality, specifically. I mean, every person you meet on the subway is a teacher, every one of them.
Right. And even AI.
Yes.
Okay, Teal, this has been a blast. And there are three questions that I ask all my guests. And the first one is, what is self-love to you?
Okay, self-love to me. Okay, to understand self-love, you have to understand fragmentation, the concept that consciousness itself within a human breaks into different parts. Now, if we understand this, then we can see very quickly how certain aspects of ourselves, parts within ourselves, we suppress, deny, and reject. Other aspects we identify with and we own and we embody, right? So internally, what we've got is this process of self-rejection, a process of self-resistance. So self-love for me is to reverse this process where instead of doing that, we're powerfully owning and integrating all the different aspects of ourself. And part of owning something in a positive way is to act in the best interests of that thing that you're positively owning. So when you're integrating and owning the aspects of yourself, you are now acting in the best interests of those aspects of yourself.
And what is happiness to you?
Happiness. This one I struggle with because there's, you know, when we say happiness, we mean so many different things. And I feel like, you know, people chase happiness as this almost like a heightened state, which is not a state that people can maintain. So I would see contentment as something that is different to happiness. Happiness being these momentary sort of aha, heightened states of positive emotion that a person can experience throughout their life experience. Whereas, you know, something like contentment is when we have found a state of alignment, we have found a state of internal peace because of our conduct with ourselves and with everything in our external existence as well, so as to not create those really painful friction points where, you know, we're not liking and not really choosing the experience that we are going through. So, yeah, I think that would be the best way to define it if I was to do that.
And what is the deeper meaning of life from your perspective?
From my perspective, the deeper meaning of life itself is a self-awareness construct. What we're calling life, right, is existence here in this time-space reality that Earth is a part of, right? When we have come into this time-space reality, we have done so understanding very powerfully that we are a fragment of Source itself that has first created this entire construct with these laws so as to insert ourselves into that construct that we have created so as to look back at ourselves. So self-awareness is literally the deeper meaning and the deepest meaning of life and existence here on Earth. But it is through that self-awareness construct which we have created that we are learning about ourselves and thus defining ourselves. And it's a lot of those things we point to as the meaning of life. For example, we've projected ourselves here. We know, for example, that what we are wanting is to feel a state of contentment. So Source itself has learned that things like happiness and contentment are important to it. But it has also learned through projecting itself here that happiness and contentment is not the full picture of what it is and who it is. It's understanding all the potentials within itself, including negative and positive. Through that experience, right, the experience of seeing ourselves from the outside, we're essentially waking up to who we are and what we are going to choose. Because Source itself, by virtue of doing this life experience, has realized that it is a conscious creator. And so it's realized that this process of figuring out what it is borderline futile, because anything that it perceives, it also creates. So because of this, there's a lot more right now energy put into, all right, let's learn more about what it is that we are wanting. And we, meaning all fragments of ourselves, that means every species, every non-physical thing in existence, everything, right, is a feedback system for what matters. And so once it gets that information about what matters to it and what it is wanting, then it has the power to consciously create. So Source itself, right, what we've been calling God, is in this process of self-awareness so as to become a conscious creator. We sort of look at it as the conscious creator. Oh, no, it's not perfectly conscious. It's using us to become perfectly conscious. We could say that Source itself is expanding by virtue of this learning hologram that it created of itself.
Wow. What an interesting perspective. Thank you so much, Teal. This has been so interesting. And I know you have a course about ancestral healing. Yep. Could you share a little bit about that now at the end?
Yeah, this I really love this thing. I mean, it's not really like I'm secret about the fact that I love ancestral healing so much. It's just like something I'm obsessed with because it's just so much fun. And, you know, a lot of these things within the spiritual field, a lot of the real deep healing work is really not fun. Ancestral healing is fun. Oh my gosh. So what I did is I designed this course, which really shows you the how of ancestral healing, because what I was noticing is that so many people, when they hear that word, it's like they're instantly overwhelmed for the reasons we've been talking about already. They hear that word and they're like, well, I didn't even know my great-grandparents. I don't know where they're from, or I'm adopted. What am I supposed to do? I can't even get into the records, right? And there's almost like this attitude that it's the information can't be found, it can't be grabbed onto, and therefore people feel in over their heads. And I wanted to reverse this process by being like, no, actually, you need to look at it in a different way. You need to understand why it's important, why it's awesome, you know, what it means in the grander picture of your life, and then break things down for people in a very step-by-step way with different assignments for how they can go about changing their ancestral patterns. The goal being, of course, that once you understand the how of it, as you move through your life and you figure out more things related to your ancestry, you will know exactly what to do with that information that you receive.
Wonderful. And I'll put a link below. Thank you so much, Teal. It was wonderful to have you back and to connect again. Thank you so much for coming to the show.
Thanks for having me on. It was great to see you again.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
If you want to become more who you are and live in alignment with your soul's purpose and explore a deeper meaning with your life, then you are most welcome to join Wisdom from North membership. If you want to go deeper, you can find all our English online courses and programs at wisdomfromnorth.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube just by searching for Wisdom from North. Until the next episode, much light from here.